Okay, we're doing session 29, February 5th, 2007, side one, and we're still in the Thompson section of the book. We're on page 71 of my original book, and we're doing another quote from the 1989 Thompson book called Imaginary Landscape, subtitled Making Worlds of Myth and Science, and this is from page 164. So let's see what it says, Scott.
History is rarely a happy place, so there's always the danger that the end of the Cold War could bring a radical convergence in which...
A racial
convergence in which a new European civilization proposed to the Russians by Gore Vidal, one that stretches westward from Vladivostok to Vancouver, will try to stand off the, quote, yellow peril of rich Japan and a prodigious China. If the cultural bifurcation of the world continues along these lines, then zones of cultural entropy in Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America will so terrify entities such as Israel and South Africa that they will never surrender to the forces of liberal tolerance, but will become entrenched technological fortresses in which the great white race makes its last stand.
Great white race, capitalized.
Right. But, persuaded by my years of living in Toronto and partaking of the insights of the Torontonian school of Innes and McLuhan, I do not think that the formations of the 19th century empires can now reassert themselves, for they were built on print bureaucracies and center-periphery dynamics of railways and shipping lanes. Shipping lines. In a global ecology of mind that is polycentric and electronic, I think that the nativistic movements of pre-modernist Islam and modernist Europe are both bound to fail, just as the ghost dance of Louis Riel's...
Just as the ghost dance, which was the American Indians, and Louis Riel, who was a Canadian.
Mm. Rising of Matisse, capital M-E-T-I-S.
Yeah. So it's the just as the ghost dance and Louis Riel's Rising of the Métis...
failed in North America. Precisely in order to avoid a world organized along lines of racial hatred, my allegiances are to such universal forms of human association as are expressed in Varela's Western Science and Eastern Buddhism.
So, let's see, he's saying here, a new European civilization proposed to the Russians by Gore Vidal, one that stretches westward from Vladivostok to Vancouver. Well, that's the Pacific Ocean, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Atlantic Ocean.
No, the Pacific Ocean. See, Vladivostok is in, over by Siberia.
Oh, okay.
Way over there, in the eastern part of Russia, as we look at Russia on the map.
Right.
And it's, of the Soviet Union back then, in the 80s when he wrote this, to Vancouver, which is on the west coast of Canada. Normally, LaRouche writes about the pan-American, pan-European dream of Gibraltar to Moscow as a great big state for the white race, the European.
Hasn't Russia been interested in maintaining its own borders? Why would it want to merge with Europe?
Because it sees itself with a Western European background as opposed to Indian China and Asia. It's always felt it's aligned with the West because it did have that literate industrial background in the 19th century. I mean, it competed with Germany and England, France, maybe Prussia in the middle of the 19th century. That's what the Crimean War was. It was getting all Western and into having a center-periphery empire. So they've had that impetus. So I associate the huge stretch of land with the European version of Russia, or European... it's almost like LaRouche wants that Remember his famous rail line across Eurasia?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to be part of that. And so, and some people say the Nazis wanted to have that Gibraltar to Moscow, have that whole. It's a huge landmass, a lot of wealth there,
mm-hmm.
and that the European elitists wanted that big chunk. That's why they were so obsessed with getting Russia in their circle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Napoleon went for Russia, Hitler went for Russia. So that's what I'm thinking is a big chunk. But he's saying, okay, history is rarely a happy place, so there's always a danger that the end of the Cold War could bring a racial convergence, which a new European civilization proposed to the Russian by Gorbachev. One that stretches westward from Vladivostok to Vancouver will try to stand off the yellow peril of a rich Japan and a prodigious China. I guess that would be north of Japan and north of China, Vladivostok
mm-hmm.
would be.
You know what racial convergence is he talking about here?
The white race. Could bring a racial convergence which a new European civilization will try to stand off, you know, go against up against Asia,
okay.
rich Japan and prodigious China, which are south of Vladivostok.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like over the Alaska zone, an arch from top of Soviet
right.
Union over into Alaska and North America, and they would circle. Remember, this is written a few years after his book Pacific Shift, where he sees the real power of the world moving to the Pacific Ocean,
mm-hmm.
Pacific Rim countries, mm-hmm. which in a lot of ways has happened. So that was the middle 80s. So now in the late 80s, he's talking about the end of the Cold War, so that the white race of America would merge with the white gang of Soviet Union
yeah.
or Russia. So the point is, if the cultural bifurcation of the world continues along these lines, then zones of cultural entropy in Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America will so terrify entities such as Israel and South Africa that they will never surrender to forces of liberal tolerance, but will become entrenched technological fortresses in which a great white race makes its last stand. So if we did have a great white race over the top, from Vladivostok to Vancouver, and then in South Africa, that would be up against the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be sort of like what we call the third world.
Why are they saying Israel and South Africa would be terrified?
They're white. They're European.
But they would come on board
with the great white racial convergence.
Right. Which may need to happen in order to resolve this Middle East issue, which is getting out of control.
Yes, that's what he worried about. But now, in the second paragraph, he's saying it's not going to happen that way.
Mm.
And then understanding that. So you see, what's interesting, he's come around. He never talked about McLuhan that way in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He never said that he'd change his view based on McLuhan. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He reacted against McLuhan in the 70s.
Right.
And that's when he went into the astral energies, or the we'll call it the fourth world cultures,
mm-hmm.
not the third world, but the fourth world.
Mm.
But then in the early 80s, he gets back into Western science, and then he's starting to look at technology a little stronger, rather than being almost a Neo-Luddite. And then he brings along his interest in Buddhism, which was always there. So he puts science and Buddhism together through people like Varela. And then that makes him look at technology or accept it a little more. And
mm-hmm.
then that retrieves McLuhan for him, or at least the vision of McLuhan about the new decentralization.
Well, I thought it was interesting that referring to the Torontonian school, he puts Innes before McLuhan. He says Innes and McLuhan.
Right, because Innes is seen as before McLuhan.
Mm.
The Torontonian school was a phrase coined by Donald Theall, you know, one of the best student of McLuhan, almost,
mm-hmm.
one of the best, did two good, great books on McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
One in 1971 called Through the Rearview Mirror? Understanding McLuhan Through the Rearview Mirror. And the second one in 2002, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
The book is The Medium is the Rearview Mirror. That's the name of the book, 1971. So he was McLuhan's first PhD student and a great scholar of Finnegan's Wake, and so he saw those aspects of McLuhan nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Thiel was a student of McLuhan from 1950 on, and he watched McLuhan and Innes encounter on the U of T campus. That's always puzzled people about the relationship between the two of them, but Don actually saw what went on and saw how McLuhan thought Innes was a bit dim. at least in understanding what McLuhan was on. But McLuhan needed Innes when he sort of went officially into media ecology in the early 60s and put the book Gutenberg Galaxy out in 1962. He said it was a footnote to Harold Innes, because Innes was a great Canadian academic. They had named a college, I don't know when they named the college after him, but they did have an Innes College by the 60s, and he died in 1952, so right when McLuhan was getting his tenure. So Innes was a great figure in Canadian academia and government consultant and international consultant. So McLuhan had to, when he, through the Gutenberg Galaxy, put on academia and tried to make it study of media ecology valid in Western left hemisphere terms, he had to evoke Innes. So that tradition that McLuhan is known for, and Theo called the Toronto School of Communications, begins with, in Theo's terms, with Innes and his colleague Havelock, Eric Havelock. Mm-hmm. So it was Innes, Havelock, then McLuhan is the Toronto School.
Mm.
So it's accurate to write it that way. Because Innes was doing his stuff before McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
His books came out in 1551.
Mm-hmm.
But he died of cancer.
Mm.
And he was born 1894, about. So, I mean, he was 17 years older, almost 20 years older than McLuhan.
And he had a profound influence on McLuhan.
Now, that's been the debate. Because McLuhan, he writes a review of Innes a year or so after Innes died in 1953, where he praises Innes and how no one understood how to read Innes, and you had to sort of know how to do it. But he criticized Innes for not having a good understanding of the arts and radical modernists, is the term Theo would use. The radical modernists, James Joyce and Eliot Pound, that Innes did not have an understanding of Joyce especially, so that he missed certain aspects of the 20th century communication media mosaic. So he actually critiques Innes. It's an essay called The Later Innes. And it's interesting. And so what is it? Why did McLuhan think that he knew something more than Innes, even though many people think that, many academics think that McLuhan was a perverted form of Innes, and they praise Innes. That's the recent late academic James Carey did that, the American academic. So it's always been an arguing point among McLuhanites and Innesites about their relationship. But Don Thiel's the only guy I actually saw them interact and saw McLuhan, at least in front of Thiel, not being very impressed with Innes. So who was he impressed with? Well, he's impressed with Ted Carpenter, says Don Thiel, the anthropologist. He learned a lot more from the anthropologist Ted Carpenter, and he learned a lot more from Wyndham Lewis. Now, a new biography of Innes has come out by a guy who did a PhD on Innes in the early 80s, a Canadian guy, and he's got it published, and he has all this unpublished stuff from Innes' records. And Innes was ransacking Wyndham Lewis, who was the big influence on McLuhan.
Mm.
Now, that's pretty interesting,
mm-hmm.
that Lewis, Wyndham Lewis, who was born off the coast of Nova Scotia, so he was Canadian, but he had an American father and a British mother, so he was a mixture of everything, but technically he was a Canadian, Wyndham Lewis was, because he fought for Canada in World War One, and eventually worked for the British but the Canadians, so he's seen as a Canadian artist, so he is the founder of the Toronto School in a way, Wyndham Lewis, but that hasn't been established generally yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's interesting about the relationship between Innes and McLuhan. McLuhan, you know, he was processing Innes the same time Innes was.
Mm.
And McLuhan had the Joycean aspect of Lewis to think about, and he would say that Innes didn't know that.
Yeah. So, but McLuhan, if we understand McLuhan through the filter of Bob, I think we would conclude that McLuhan was more advanced. He took Innes to the next level.
To understand McLuhan, he wasn't influenced by one person. And there's the McLuhan the writer, the McLuhan the scientist, McLuhan the talker, McLuhan the medium. There's all kinds of McLuhans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just look at McLuhan the writer and you look at him as a studying media, as some kind of new subject called the media of communication, you would become too literary in relation to McLuhan, and you wouldn't understand why he wrote differently, what appeared to be flippantly, in the 60s and 70s. You have to understand...
Yeah, he was trying to mime the new media dance, and,
yeah,
and maybe...
Yeah, you have to really see the new media dance, how it's... You have to really see its contours and characteristics, and usually literate people can't see that. And
right.
The best way to train yourself to see through the literate bias and see the media dance that McLuhan was aware of, and certainly Innes, we don't know if he could have taken it in the 60s, but McLuhan was more able to respond to the new media world that was so different from the radio and just beginning TV world that Innes encountered. And the way to get that training to break through literate bias is through Finnegan's Wake. So McLuhan would emphasize Finnegan's Wake as a means to get beyond your literate bias, which would maybe have you favor, if you were a serious academic, Innes over McLuhan, because you'd be a print-oriented bastard, a P.O.B.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, McLuhan was not a P.O.B. He was not limited to the literate world.
Mm-hmm.
So that is with the Bob view, you could say.
Well, he was at least one quarter P.O.B.
Yeah, oh yeah, I know, it was an ecology of different media, but he understood the dynamics of the society were so different from the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, well, by now they kind of see it, but they didn't know it in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
when McLuhan was writing about Innes.
Mm-hmm.
But when McLuhan was in the university environment, and he wanted to be a serious academic or present himself in that context, he had to hoik up Innes. So he would say in academic context that his work was a footnote to Innes.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to note the audience he was saying that to.
Yeah.
So that's the problem.
So there's these different images of McLuhan depending on who you are.
And who he's addressing.
Yeah.
And who you identify with, or what media
right.
you think you're against or pro.
Yeah. Yeah, the P.O.B. is never going to be a tetrad manager, because he doesn't understand, and, you know, and McLuhan
right.
was a tetrad manager.
Right. Okay, so we're looking at this, so he's saying, thanks to McLuhan, and he's right to pick up this part of McLuhan, that McLuhan does give you a clue to why you're not going to have old empires retrieved. I mean, right now, the international globalized, virtualized economy does not want territory. To be powerful in the present-day world, you want information flows.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a place. I mean, that's what collapsed Soviet Union. They had too much of a big territorial situation, and they couldn't be mobile in relation to the global virtual economy,
mm-hmm.
which is what we're going to discuss with Croker when we get to the Arthur Croker section. So Thompson is on the right track here when he says something new is going to show up. A new kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not worried about the racial or fundamentalisms. Now, today, we do have this fundamentalist stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is written before that. He says that there will be what he calls nativistic movements. So Thompson sees the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic movements, radical Islamics, as nativistic movements, which we've had since the Telegraph.
Mm-hmm.
The ghost dance was the American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Going through a fatalistic response to the end of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then Louis Riel was the Métis. The Métis were half, I think they were half-breeds, mixture of French, English, and native Canadians.
He's using the word ghost dance as a metaphor.
No, that's what they were... No, it's not a metaphor. It's the actual attempt to revitalize American Indian culture out west, generally, western United States, since it was being threatened by modernism, industrialism coming into their territory. They were dislocated, and by the early 1890s, they were trying to revitalize their own culture. And it was, some people might say, well, they're Neo-Luddites, you know, trying to retrieve and drop out and revitalize their own native rituals in relation to the looming threat of Christianization.
Mm-hmm.
So Thompson's saying that kind of movement is an archetype now in relation to what happened in the 20th century when you have these nativistic movements anywhere from the hippie movement to Waco, the Waco David Koresh kind of movements, all these retreating from industrial society and going out in the wilderness and waiting for the end of the world, those kind kind of cults and situations, those are what Thompson's referring to as nativistic movements.
And who's Louis Riel and the rising of the Métis?
Métis. The Métis were a combination product of the French and English colonists mating with the Canadian, what are called the Canadian First Nations, which are the Inuit or Eskimos, the different tribes of Indians. So the Métis were a culture in Winnipeg, in that area. And they actually had a revolution. They had a rebellion, fought against the colonists and got wiped out. So he's saying that, see, Thompson is part of the nativistic movement in the 70s by trying to retrieve that pure craft kind of culture and sacred geometry and all the stuff that we were talking about in the first part of the Thompson section, all those things that he was trying to retrieve. You know, he was an educated hippie in a way, sophisticated hippie. So he was an important thinker in the counterculture. He's realizing by the late 80s that those that he was symptomatic of the nativistic movements in American culture in the 70s. And he's saying that's not practical in relation to what's coming. And he's actually enthusiastic, optimistic about the tribal paranoia of the great white race or the different cultural global fundamentalisms from different cultures. They will not be able to get a ground and a foundation once you're living in the discarnate electronic world, which he describes as a global ecology of mind that's polycentric and electronic. And that would be polycentric was his definition for of chaos. Many centers interacting, which was a 19th century version of chaos. Or it's the term chaos, remember he objected to the chaos metaphysicians and physicists who were, he thought, really just talking about Galilean dynamics in a hyper-dialogue, whereas the New World was something beyond the polycentric interaction. So he's saying global ecology of mind is polycentric and electronic. Electronic goes beyond the interface of different cities around the world.
Yeah, but he likes Abraham, Ralph Abraham's chaos.
Well, he learned about chaos from Ralph Abraham, but he likes Ralph Abraham for his history of mathematics knowledge that Thompson can map onto his chart, which we went through in previous sessions. It's not that he likes these guys. He says these people reflect changes, but from Thompson's point of view, they're still rearview mirror people projecting, they're at least responding to the new environment, but they're projecting old models on it.
Well, I thought he linked the planetization phase, which we're in now, to the chaos dynamics.
No, he calls it the planetization, the planetary shift, or the phrase planetization he uses in the phrase the planetization of the esoteric. And he says what I call the astral body energies, or that fourth world energies, ancient energies, nativistic energies, that those have become part of a, in quotes, new age market commodification all around the planet. There's the planetization of the esoteric, and then there's the planetization of technology, which is what he calls a global ecology of mind.
Which you're saying he sees as being post-chaos dynamics.
Yeah, he says to see chaos in it is to miss the patterns of order. But it's not a literate order. It's an order of dialogue.
Well, order emerges from chaos.
Yeah, that's part of the chaos theory. But he thinks the order that the chaos metaphysicians or physicians are thinking of is a retrieval of literate order.
Yeah, so they're dealing with the afterimage of visual space.
Right. Now, Thompson uses the term singularity. He says at times of singularity, that would be his term for the post-chaotic, he says no culture, no model holds up, and it's apocalyptic or catastrophic, as he says. He said he's a catastrophist. So he's not expecting, and he says this in his interviews, much harmony. But at least the old forms of violence won't be able to get a foothold because they'll be subject to the, quote, chaos, too.
Yeah.
Or to the catastrophes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just bought a cup of coffee from Pete's Coffee, which is kind of like Starbucks, and you look at the logo, the print that they have on their cups, and it's like, you know, a gecko from the Dreamtime or something like that. So,
what is a gecko?
It's a little lizard that you find,
gotcha,
like in Australia.
Yeah.
It has an aboriginal sort of
connotation.
Yeah, connotation. So this planetization of the esoteric is being turned into marketing logos.
Well, that's the Pacific Rim imagery that he talked about in the book Pacific Shift. I mean, here you are in Oregon, and you're getting Australian imagery.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's part of the marketization of the fourth world.
Mm-hmm. So
that's not McLuhan's fourth world. That was the electronic world. But some people, when they talk about the first world is Europe, advanced capitalism. Second world is Russian bureaucracy. That's McLuhan's terms. Third world is the undeveloped countries, but beginning to be developed. The fourth world that some people use is like Amazonian natives that Terence McKenna hung out with.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fourth world in some people's terms, but not McLuhan's definition of fourth world. But Thompson would use the fourth world, I guess, in the sense of very primitive ancient cultures.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's throwing in pre-modernist Islam and Indian and Native American culture. And
yeah, I guess you could say definitely the First Nations in Canada and like the Eskimos and the Indians are fourth world cultures.
So he's saying rather than these having these fourth world cultures retreat into their heritage, trying to reinvoke the ancestors and revitalize themselves based on their past culture, that he likes what Varela expresses in his Western science and Eastern Buddhism as being a new model for synthesis and a way to move forward as opposed to a way of retreating into the past.
Yeah, it's almost like he's not into culture. He's into almost a religious view of individuals meeting and having a sense of being universal and not being limited by their tribal identity.
Mm-hmm.
What's called, as he says, there are universal forms of human association.
Right.
Does
that necessarily need to destroy the cultural uniqueness, or can individuals maintain their cultural uniqueness while participating, you know, in a universal form of association?
Well, it seems that Thompson would be cynical in relation to the ways that cultures are preserved today, these nativistic cultures. How is it done? Through tourism.
Oh, yeah.
So the 80s and 90s with the ecotourism, and I mean, you can go to different parts of these fourth world cultures, and they have something for tourists there, right? They perform. They perform their old dances. And you often see the Queen of England going around to Africa and the Commonwealth countries and watching the performance of these old rituals.
Right.
So Thompson would not see any real cultural depth in the touristic propping up of these cultures.
And then today we have the Native Americans maintaining their tribal identity through running gambling casinos.
Yeah, because they have to deal with the virtual economy. They got to integrate with money.
Yeah.
And with information and money. So they are being forced to be in Quadrophenic. They got their rituals on their for the tourists and whatever they do secretly among the tribes, and then they function as businessmen.
Yeah. Well, just on a side note, about 10, 12 years ago, I met this guy who was the chief of the Yaqui Nation, and he came out to Malibu and he brought some youngsters with him to perform this rain dance, which is deer dance, which is considered a very powerful, revitalizing, and is usually only done in secrecy. And he was the reason why he was bringing this to the West Coast was because he wanted to raise money for a museum. He wanted to put his cultural heritage into a museum because he realized that the new kids growing up in the tribe no longer identified with the Yaqui way of living, But just on a side note, I don't know if this is sort of off topic, but he said that I asked him about Carlos Castaneda because Carlos grounded his work in the, and you know, he said that Don Juan was a Yaqui shaman, and that's what he grounded all his work in. And he said, when I die and go into the astral plane, I'm going after that guy. He ripped us off.
Yeah, no, that that's a fourth world cultural fad that was retrieved and begun with the hippie culture around Castaneda. You know, he retrieved that for a media situation, and so an actual fourth world culture person is rejecting, rebelling against the mediaization of it through through Carlos Castaneda.
Right.
But that's a nativistic attitude. I'm going to get him on the astral plane. He ripped us off.
Yeah.
He's got the matey sensibilities. We're going to rebel. So
what's Varela's Western science and Eastern Buddhism? What, how do you look at that?
Varela was a cognitive scientist and a member of Thompson's Lindisfarne. He's a, matter of fact, Thompson's son wrote a book or two with Francesco Varela. And Varela, if you read the book by Catherine Hales called How We Became Posthuman, she's a literary professor in California. She talks about the phases in the cybernetics world. There was the Norbert Wiener Macy conferences in the 40s, and then Humberto...
Eco?
No, Humberto Maturana, I think his name is. He was the teacher for Francesco Varela. The two of them made some developments that became ground for modeling in computer worlds in the 70s, Maturana and Varela. And that was a second phase of computer modeling and how to make computers and what cognitive models to use. They improved upon the Macy conferences of the 40s and 50s. And then the third phase, I can't remember who she had down for that, but the third phase was where we are today with more virtual reality technologies. So Varela is recognized as an important person in the cognitive sciences that were providing models for how computers should mime our brains.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a Buddhist, or he was an Argentinian, or maybe no, Chilean, and he converted to Buddhism, I think.
Hmm. So this sounds like a hybridization of computers and humans.
Right, and if you look at my chart, I have the printed book as the subtext of the computer meme. This is Thompson projecting the idea of universal forms of human association. That's a product of writing.
Mm-hmm.
He's projecting a POB or literate bias here. He's sticking with that idea. And that may be what will unite the religions, the ecumenical movement, and eventually they will represent the best values of the literate sensibility of visual space, which is recognizing individuals and them all having a sort of common universal identity. But there's a crisis lying in that, I think, that Croker brings in.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he resolved this toward later on, but when Lilly first wrote the book, The Scientist, he was concerned about what he saw as the confrontation between the solid state and the carbon-based entities. And so there is this sense of, are we going to lose our humanity if we become too spliced in with the solid state entity? And it sounds to me like that's the domain that Varela's working in.
Yeah, probably. The thing is, though, when you talk about Western science, science is so corrupt today, it doesn't even function like what people understand science should do. And you see that in how the drug cartels use fake science to prop up their drugs, new drugs, and scientists are basically paid to create certain results, models to support the erroneous drug. And then religion, that's not as solid as before. Any religions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Thompson is relying on something that even McLuhan realized is weak. McLuhan said the Catholic faith can't, built on literacy, cannot survive the electronic polycentric chaos or catastrophe.
Hmm.
So I see Thompson as relying back on his POB sensibility here, even though he himself is not, you know, a guy going to church every weekend or something.
Right.
He tends to be a meditator. So it's just what he writes about, maybe rearview mirror, but his own sensibility, I think, is pretty post-postmodern.
Well,
he's probably what Don Thiel would call a Joycean anarchist.
Yeah.
But he has a sense of responsibility about the public spaces and what to say about them.
Yeah. Well, with his sense of the bardos is becoming more musical and mathematical, and then affecting the physical plane and causing it to become more musical and mathematical, and
within the singularity of this convergence of,
but using archetypal imagery such as, you know, these are the new angelic forms or resonances, and then now to hear him bringing in Varela and the cybernetic computer aspect puts a certain bite, kind of an electrical bite, into his imagery of...
I mean, it makes him more not-so-rearview mirror.
Yeah, because, you know, whereas he's dealing with sort of the theology of the past and the Blavatsky-Steiner kind of imagery,
yeah,
in the talks and works that I've read and heard of his, now to be bringing in the cybernetic dimension, this new electric matrix, which seems to be at variance with the older theological views.
Right. Now, you're hearing tapes done in the early 90s, which is the transition from what he's writing here in the late 80s to the late 90s when he takes on virtual reality. He's even, you know, more, quote, hip than what he seems to be in the quote you're picking up here.
Mm-hmm.
He's even adapts even more in the late 90s and writes even... or confronts even a more further out, quote, science fiction possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely by the late 90s is not relying on any of the older forms, Steiner or anything.
Yeah.
But we're seeing the transition here.
Yeah.
And this quote's another example of his transition.
Right.
Moving out of his nativistic tendencies.
Yeah. In the first paragraph...
And he wrote these books in the 80s to wake up the New Agers and those that... of the boomer generation that went into the nativistic tendencies. He knew that they were going to fall behind and not be aware of what was really going on, and that's why he had to bring McLuhan back in.
Yeah. Yeah, this was bringing a new orientation into that mindset.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I just wanted to, back in the first paragraph where he talks about the cultural bifurcation of the world continues along these lines, then zones of cultural entropy in Africa and the Middle East and Latin America. What is he referring to as the cultural entropy in Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America?
I guess what we see today in the Middle East. The fact that they just aren't going to be able to adapt to the industrial society fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, Africa suffered through the 90s. The Middle East is led to this situation. Latin America in the 80s with nothing but death squads,
uh-huh,
dictatorships. It was very bleak in the 80s when he was writing in Africa and the Middle East and Latin America.
Yeah.
Now, things have changed. It's still bleak in those areas, but it's different now after the Cold War and with the virtual economy, the recolonization of those areas, especially Africa, but still the AIDS crisis, starvation. It's just a mess. And he writes in the late 80s, he did a talk, and he talked about the charisma of the black through music, black American or the black cultures through music, the charisma of the Native American, what's called the Reds, in Hollywood and in movies, but that the Arabs had no charisma, no mass media kind of glamour that would prop up the local Arabs' identity.
Right, they're just thought of as... camel jockeys, right?
Yeah.
That's the American idea of those guys.
Right. And so they never created rap or anything. So he wrote about that there was something very dark brewing in the Middle East because of that. They were left out of the race, so they had, you know, out of the cultural race.
It's interesting that Zappa liked to invoke their image, like Shake Your Booty, where he's got the towel head image on the cover of it, and he's...
Well, Zarab had Arab in him, Arab blood.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay.
Yeah. He did had, I think, Greek, Sicilian, French, and Arab.
Hmm.
But the... he was making fun of the of the Saudis and the Arab billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
But in his music, he used Bulgarian music, Arabian music, Asian Indian music. He used the whole global, he was doing world music, but not the way world music became marketed.
Mm-hmm.
But he was doing world music plus.
Mm.
Yeah, so anyways, yeah, so, but the Thompson, it's a prediction that is borne out by 911. He said there's something dark that's going to come out of the fact the Arab cultures do not have a media fashionable image, something that had, that could be sold in the global entertainment market.
The only difference between them, Africa, and Latin America was that they had the money to be able to actually create a real rebellion.
Right, and
Africa and Latin America just suffered.
That's right, but the Saudis, their elites get the money.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Kuwait, and McLuhan wrote about Kuwait in the late 60s about how everybody was a millionaire because they really controlled the wealth, and how, if you broke it down, everybody who was a Kuwaiti had access to the wealth. I don't know if that's the way it is now, but you have Dubai and United Arab Emirates, you have different pro-Western Arab countries, but generally most of them are run by elites that keep the people in pretty backward conditions,
mm-hmm.
like the Saudis do. And I guess Iranian is a different form of backwardness. Iraqis, they did have the most industrial culture in the 80s and 90s, but they got wiped out due to the extreme dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. So it's a lot of confusion. What's interesting, McLuhan said he predicted this violence in the Middle East in the 50s. He said the United Nations was bringing in transistor radios. And he said the radio will inflame the tribal identities and conflicts in the Middle East because these people would not have the immunity to radio because they weren't literate.
Mm-hmm.
So he predicted real problems in the Middle East just through radio, handed out in the 50s, and that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And then Thompson tends to emphasize cultural content, so he's talking about the Arabs can't get into the global market, like we talked about how the Generation Xers, the punk rockers, were able to create their own culture in the music industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Arabs have been left out of the...
Well, not left out. They just haven't put... They haven't figured out how to interact. Because they're stubborn about maintaining their tribal identity.
Yeah, their nativistic movements. But they just good lousy music.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm just saying that facetiously. What can they market about themselves that is charismatic? I mean, the blacks had something going. They had great music.
Well, but you mean the tribal blacks that originated in Africa, or the blacks in America?
Blacks.
Yeah, well, they were in this American cultural mix, which caused them to have to find a new identity and become creative.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
aren't
Africans. They put on the African identity, but they're not Africans.
Yeah.
They're industrial Americans.
Yeah.
Okay,
but
so the Middle East was left out of the loop because they didn't have industry.
Well, they lived in a desert. What kind of cultural complexity comes out of sand dunes?
Didn't the band America sing a song in the 70s about going to the desert?
Yeah.
Or was that Steely Dan? Maybe that was Steely Dan.
No Name or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. The Horse with No Name?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, Baudrillard, who was part of the Croker section of the book, he says the desert is the real image. He wrote this in the 80s. He travels on the desert in the United States, and he says the desert is an example of the disappearance of electronic man, the disappearance of social space. So he says the desert is a charismatic image. So the Arabs failed to market the desert charisma.
Mm. But continuing with this sentence, the cultural bifurcation of the world continues along these lines, and zones of cultural entropy in Africa, Middle East, and Latin America will so terrify entities such as Israel and South Africa that they will never surrender to forces of liberal tolerances. He's saying Israel and South Africa will never surrender to liberal tolerance, or he's saying the Middle East will never?
No, he's saying Israel and South Africa, and it turned out in the 80s, when he's writing this, that Israel was funding a lot of the apartheid industries and had a very negative profile in terms of human rights in propping up the apartheid regime to South Africa.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, no, that's part of the... If you read, people who are anti-Zionists or anti-Semites, depending on how you look at criticism of Zionism, if you're anti-Zionist, many people accuse you of being anti-Semite, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you if you drop that proviso and just actually read what the right-wing governments of Israel did in the 80s and early 90s, it's pretty bad.
Oh.
Guns and dope dealing.
Why were they interested in interfering with South Africa?
Don't know. I can't remember. That's a whole other topic. I mean, it gets into if you remember, the Zionists allied with the Nazis in the 30s, just because they needed support to oust the British,
uh-huh.
to build the country of Israel. So it was a very controversial history to the formation of Israel.
Uh-huh.
And some people say out of that, LaRouche writes about this, out of the Vladimir Jabotinsky networks, came Begin and Shimon Peres and Sharon, the extreme right-wing part of Israeli politics, came out of the Jabotinsky tradition, which was a tough, mean tradition compared to the left-wingers and utopians of Israel. And so those guys got the upper hand in Israel in the late 70s, early 80s, and they worked. If you talk to LaRouche, she talks about how Israel worked with the far-right neo-Nazi networks around the world, and those networks worked with the South.